Right, I think I'm going to start because we're only going to do revision the first time. Though I've taken pity on you this week after the appalling performance last week. I'm not asking quite so many questions. Last week, if you remember, we learnt how to evaluate deductive arguments as either valid or invalid by constructing counterexamples. Can anyone tell me what a counterexample is?
It's an argument which reproduces exactly the premises of the argument and a conclusion which has been made the opposite by a not. It is not the case.
Okay. Now, there was only one thing wrong with what you said. So, what's your name?
Orsa
said a counterexample is an argument that has exactly the premises plus the conclusion with not in front of it. Now, there's something wrong with that. That was a good answer, apart from this.
I think it's not an argument.
It's not an argument. It's very importantly not an argument. A counterexample is a set of sentences. So you make a counterexample from an argument, because if you remember, an argument is a set of sentences where one thing is being asserted on the basis of the others, whereas a counterexample set, none of them is being asserted. You're just checking to see that. So what are you checking the counterexample set for? Can anyone tell me?
Consistency.
You're checking it for consistency. And what is it for a set of sentences to be consistent? Can anyone tell me what it is for a set of sentences to be consistent?
Well, they all reflect the same thing. They all deal with.
No, not necessarily. They're almost certainly relevant to each other.
Yeah.
So in that sense, they deal with the same thing. But that's not what makes them consistent.
Are they valid?
No, sentences are never valid. Only arguments are valid. And just as arguments can't be true because only sentences are true, sentences can't be valid because only arguments are valid.
I'm guessing that consistency is that all the sentences are true.
Right. It's not that all the sentences are true.
Isn't it that consistency then shows us that the argument is bad or not valid? Something on those
It's
lines.
Certainly the case that when we check the counterexample set for consistency, this will tell us whether the argument is valid or not. But I'm still trying to work out what it is for a set of sentences to be consistent.
All true together.
Right. Is it that they're all true together or that they can be all true together? It's the latter, isn't it? A set of sentences is consistent if there's a possible situation, a logically possible situation, in which all are true together. And that situation needn't be the actual situation. They needn't actually be true. All that's necessary is that they could be true together. And that is a logically possible situation where the premises are true and the conclusion false. So if the counterexample set is consistent, if you remember, the counterexample set is the premises plus the negation of the conclusion. If those sentences can all be true together, this is a logically possible situation in which the premises are true and the conclusion is false. Because if the negation of the conclusion is true, the conclusion is false. Okay, you've got to take on board all these definitions, and I realise that they're hard, but they're not hard once you just familiarise yourself with them. Once you learn what they mean, you'll be able to play with them as I do. There was one other thing slightly wrong. You said with not put in front. Actually, it's what are the words we put in front of the conclusion to create the negation of the conclusion?
It is not the case.
Well done. Okay, so we evaluate a deductive argument as either valid or invalid by taking the counterexample set, which consists of the premises plus the negation of the conclusion, and seeing if they can be consistent. If the counterexample set can be consistent, then the argument is
invalid.
No arguments are ever false. Okay, invalid, that's right. And if the counterexample set is inconsistent, the argument is
valid.
Valid. Well done. Yeah, that's right. So it seems wrong, doesn't it? Because consistency ought to go with validity. But I hope you can see why it doesn't. And you'll see why it doesn't as soon as you understand what consistent means, what valid means, and truth and false and so on. Okay, we also saw that valid arguments can have false premises and false conclusions. Is everyone happy with that? And we saw that invalid arguments can have true premises, true conclusions. So that's another rather irritating thing, isn't it? So just as inconsistency of a counterexample ought to go with invalidity and doesn't, it's also, you feel like saying that valid arguments ought to have true conclusions and true, but they don't. And why don't they? What is it for an argument to be valid? It's for it to be truth-preserving. Well done. Okay. So that doesn't mean that the conclusion is true. It means that, what is it for an argument to be truth-preserving?
If the premises are true, then the conclusion must be true.
Good. There is no logically possible situation in which the premises are true and the conclusion false. So if the premises are true, the conclusion must be true. That's what it is for an argument to be truth-preserving. That's what it is to be valid. And of course, even if an argument has false premises and a false conclusion, it might still be the case that there is no logically possible situation in such that if the premises were true, the conclusion would be also true or false. I got lost in the middle of that sentence. I hope you can complete it for yourself. Okay, we also looked at how to evaluate deductive arguments from the perspective of everyday life. Because if you remember, all logicians are concerned with this validity. They're really not interested in everything else. What is everyone else interested in?
Relevance
as well. Okay, good. And soundness, somebody said. What is it for an argument to be sound?
Must be valid and...
And.
Good. There's an and, yes. So what an argument is sound only if it's valid and it has true premises. That's right. It can't be true itself, of course, because no argument is true. Good. Well done. Okay, you did some thinking this week, didn't you, after last week? Jolly good. Okay, we also looked at the paradoxes of entailment. Can anyone tell me one of the paradoxes of entailment? We had a bit of trouble with these because they are paradoxes. It's very difficult to understand them. Anyone tell me one of the paradoxes of entailment? No? Okay, a paradox of entailment would be something like grass is green, therefore 2 + 2 = 4. Now that argument is valid. Can anyone tell me why? Because what?
Both premises are true.
No, because both premises being true is not a sufficient condition for validity. Because both premises could be true without the arguments being truth-preserving, couldn't there? And here we've got a premise and a conclusion. Grass is green is the premise. 2 + 2 = 4 is the conclusion. Anyone tell me why that argument is valid? Well, it wouldn't pass the test of it's not, well, but no, that's just a definition of what it is for it to be valid, if you like. So let's have another look at it again. Where's my pen? Grass is green, therefore 2 + 2 = 4. And I've said that that's valid, which means there is no possible situation in which the premise is true and the conclusion false. Okay, why does that satisfy that definition?
Because the conclusion is always true.
Because the conclusion can't be false. That's right. So there is no possible situation in which the premise is true and the conclusion false, because there's no possible situation in which the conclusion is false. Is there?
No.
Do you see? So that just by definition falls into the definition of validity. And you might say that that's reasonable, because surely a necessary truth should be entailed by everything. And the other, can anyone tell me the other paradox of entailment? No, that's a tautology. It's a contradiction is used. So if we've got 2 + 2 = 5, therefore grass is green, that's the other paradox of entailment, because if there's no possible situation in which that is true, then there's no possible situation in which that's true and that's false. So by default, that has to be valid. Which again, you might think, well, anything follows from a contradiction. In uttering a contradiction, I don't limit any possibilities, do I? So if I say I'm wearing a skirt and it's not the case that I'm wearing a skirt, I say nothing, don't I? Mm-hmm. There isn't a single possibility I have ruled out, and therefore I've said nothing. So you might think of that as a way to wrap your mind around that. Okay, what is this for an argument to be sound? We've done that. Why circular arguments shouldn't persuade us of anything? Why are circular arguments valid? Can anyone tell me? Circular arguments are always valid. So if we have... go on.
Because one of the premises is the same as the conclusion.
Good, that's right. So all whales are mammals. Therefore, all whales are mammals. Now, that's valid because there's no possible situation in which that's true and that's false, is there? How could there be? They're the same thing. But so we've got they're valid, relevant, and in this case, sound as well, aren't they? So, I mean, this should be a really good... But why might we not notice that this is a circular argument? Can anyone tell me why...
If you add a lot more premises.
If you add a lot more premises, go on.
Ready to?
Yes.
I kind of finished. Are all saying the same thing?
No, not quite. Can anyone tell me?
It would be distracting.
It would distract from the validity fee, but go on.
If the conclusion is one of the premises, then it will be valid.
That's right. It doesn't matter how many other things that you add here, because of the monotonicity of validity, it would still be valid, because if the premises is amongst the conclusions, then it doesn't matter how many other premises you add, the conclusion would still be amongst the premises, wouldn't it? And if it can't be the case that that's true and that's false, then it can't be the case that all the premises are true and yet the conclusion false, because one of the premises is the conclusion, isn't it? So we may not notice a circular argument, and we may think, oh, that sounds valid, that sounds like a good argument, but we fail to notice that indeed it is valid, but it's valid because it's circular, which isn't a good argument. Okay, good, well done. That was, you've redeemed yourselves. Okay, so just to see where we are now in what we're doing, we know how to recognise arguments now. We know how to analyse arguments now, how to identify their premises and their conclusions, and we know how to set them out logic book style. We know how to distinguish deductive arguments from inductive arguments. Do you remember? Because you can always tell a priori whether deductive arguments are good or not, whereas you need to look at background information to tell whether deductive arguments are good. Okay, and we also, last week, we learned how to evaluate deductive arguments. So this week, we're going to learn first we're going to talk a bit more about the nature of induction. Then we're going to reflect on the value of induction. Then we're going to look at the different types of induction. And finally, we're going to learn how to evaluate the different types of induction. So you'll have learned then how to evaluate both deductive and inductive arguments. So you'll be able to recognise arguments, analyse arguments, set them out logic book style, and evaluate them. Okay, so inductive arguments are ampliative, such that they add something that can't be logically deduced from the premises. So do you remember that with deduction, The conclusion is always included in the premises because the conclusion is a logical consequence of the premises. That's why they're either valid or invalid. Because there can't be any possible situation where the premises are true and the conclusion false, because the conclusion is logically entailed by the premises. So if you like, the premises already include the conclusion logically. Whereas with inductive arguments, that isn't true. We can actually learn something new from an inductive argument. So they add something that can't be logically deduced from the premises, which is why we never get certainty from an inductive argument, no matter how good it is. And inductive arguments are not monotonic. They can always be made weaker or stronger by additional information. Do you remember I looked at, I think this one got you quite exercised. I can't remember what it was now, but Jones took the knife out of the chap's chest, or the policeman saw the knife being plunged into Jones's. Actually, I've got it all wrong because I can't remember what it was. But do you remember that one?
Yes.
And do you remember how whatever I added to it completely changed, yes, whether it was a strong argument into a weak argument or a weak argument into a strong argument? And that's because with inductive arguments, you can always do that, because none of them are certain, none of them are conclusive. So whereas with deductive arguments, they're always either conclusively valid or conclusively invalid. With inductive arguments, they're either weak or strong, and you can change their weakness or strongness by adding more information. And inductive arguments can only ever be evaluated by bringing to bear background information about their subject matter. So whereas you can look at a deductive argument, and as long as you understand the logical word, the ands or the ors or the ifs or the only ifs, etc., you can tell whether the argument is valid or invalid. You don't even need to know what the content is. Do you remember I talked about widgets being something or other? Widgets being what?
Halibut, something like that.
It was a completely made up word, but you were still able to tell whether the argument was valid because you don't need to understand the content of the argument in order to determine its validity if the argument is valid, if the argument is deductive. Whereas with inductive arguments, you always need to bring to bear your background information, and therefore you need to understand the content. If you don't understand the content of the argument, you won't be able to evaluate it. Okay, so those are three properties of inductive arguments, and they all stem from the same thing, which is that inductive arguments rely on what this chap here, David Hume, very famous Scottish philosopher, calls the principle of the uniformity of nature. And the principle of the uniformity of nature tells us that the future will always be like the past. The future will always be like the past underpins every single inductive argument. If you think about it, it underpins everything a scientist, for example, will do. So the core of science is replication of an experiment. If you do an experiment and you get one result, you'll want that experiment to be replicated by other people, and they get the same result, or in biology, or a similar result, or something like that. But you want it to be replicated. But of course, that means you're relying on this premise, aren't you? You're relying on the idea that the future will be like the past. If you do this, under these conditions, you will get this result. Doesn't matter where, doesn't matter when, doesn't matter, you know, all sorts of other things. If you do this, under these conditions, you will get that result. And that's the principle of the uniformity of nature. I contrast it with the principle of charity. Do you remember I mentioned the principle of charity to you?
No. Didn't I?
I see. You can fight it out later. Can anyone tell me what the principle of charity is?
Go on then.
Are you there? Because I happen to know that you've been at another lecture of mine where I was talking about charity.
So oh, yes, of course.
Yes, exactly. Okay, does anyone else think I talked about charity?
No.
No? Oh, right, okay. In that case, I'm not going to start talking about charity now, because I'm currently listening by you. if we have time after questions, I'll talk about charity. But actually, no, I have to do it now, don't I?
Yes.
We need the principle of uniformity of nature in order to understand the physical world. We believe that the future will be like the past, and that any physical object, if it behaves in a certain way under certain conditions, will behave in that same way whenever the conditions are the same. But we don't believe that when we're talking to each other. If I want to understand you, then what I've got to use is what's called the principle of charity, which is the idea that evidence for error is not irregularity, as it is with the principle of the uniformity of nature. It's unintelligibility. So if I'm talking to you and you strike me as saying something obviously false, now at that point I can say, well, what an idiot, not talking to him again, and walk away. Or I can say, oh, that's interesting. Why are you saying that? You know, why did you say P? I believe not P. This is why I believe not P. Why do you believe P? And we might discover that we're both wrong. Or I might discover that I'm wrong. Or he might discover he's wrong. Or we know with evidence of unintelligibility that there's evidence for error, but we don't know where that error lies. So whereas evidence for irregularity is evidence for error in the physical world, evidence of unintelligibility or irrationality is evidence for error in the human world, if you like, in the rational world. I can say more about that in the questions if anyone's interested. But what's important for induction is that the principle of the uniformity of nature underpins every single inductive argument. And of course, we've got a difficulty here, because that means that even our strongest inductive arguments, like the sun has risen every single day in the history of the world, therefore the sun will rise tomorrow, that's a pretty strong inductive argument. But how do we know we're not like Russell's chicken? Bertrand Russell talks about the chicken who every day in the whole of its life, the farmer had come out to give it its breakfast, its corn for breakfast or whatever chickens eat. So this day the farmer came out and the chicken thought, oh good, breakfast, and got its neck wrung. How do we know we're not in that position with respect to the sun? Answer, we don't. We have no idea. We expect the future to be like the past, but there's nothing we can do to argue for the claim that the future is like the past. Any argument that we attempt to make for it, it's going to be a circular argument. So if we say that the future has always been like the past in the past, therefore the future will be like the past in the future, okay, you can see how that, again, rests on the circle. It rests on the principle of the uniformity of nature again. And no matter how we try and justify the PUN, it always comes out in a circle. It can't be justified at all. Nevertheless, we firmly believe it. Not only do we believe it, Hume argued that we can't not believe that the future will be like the past. It's actually impossible for us not to expect that this will happen again if in the past that has always happened. Hume thinks that it's part of the very structure of human thought. But, he says, it's not rational. By that, he didn't mean that it's irrational. He meant that it's non-rational. So the opposite of rational is not really irrational, because in order to be irrational, you've got to be rational, haven't you? This table can't be irrational, can it?
No.
And that's because this table is non-rational. It just doesn't engage in reasoning. So I engage in reasoning, therefore I can be irrational. So irrationality is a failure, if you like, in the house of reason. And non-rationality is the opposite of rationality. And Hume thinks that inductive reasoning is not, in a way, reasoning at all. It's not rational, it's just something that we are forced to do because that's the way our brain is structured. Very interesting, isn't it? Some philosophers have believed that this shows that we should reject induction as a means of acquiring knowledge. After all, surely knowledge should be based on reason. Reason is what leads us to knowledge. And if inductive inductive argument isn't rational, if it's not rational at all, then it shouldn't be. It's not a way of acquiring knowledge. So Karl Popper, who's a very famous philosopher of science, he argued that the only good arguments are deductive arguments. And he said that a scientist should never try and confirm hypotheses, and they should never claim to know that a theory is true. Okay. Instead, they should try and falsify hypotheses, and at most they should say of a theory is that it hasn't yet been falsified. Okay, so they should never actually say it's true. And the idea behind this is that whenever you try and confirm something, you're using deductive arguments. So you're saying, if all swans are white, then the next swan I see is going to be white. And if the next one you see is white, then there's a sort of little tick. But there are all sorts of problems with the logic of confirmation. And somebody wanted me to talk about GRU. And again, if we have time in questions, I'll talk a bit about GRU. The rest of you can just wonder what on earth I'm talking about. But let me instead quickly give you the raven's paradox. If all ravens are black, that should be confirmed by the sighting of a black raven, shouldn't it? So the sighting of a black raven gives you a tick in the box beside all ravens are black. But would you think that all ravens are black is also confirmed by the sighting of a white gym shoe? Would you?
Not immediately.
Okay. But actually, all ravens are black is logically equivalent to all non-black things are non-ravens, isn't it? All ravens are black is logically equivalent to, let me write that down.
Because it doesn't say exclusively ravens are black, though.
No, hold on, let me write it down so you can see what I'm saying. Can you all see this?
Yes.
All ravens are black is logically equivalent to, that's what that means, all non-black things are non-ravens.
Yeah.
Do you accept that?
Yes.
All non-black things are non-ravens. So what the logical equivalence means is that couldn't be true unless that is true, and that couldn't be true without that being true. These are true and false in exactly the same conditions. Fair enough?
Shouldn't you have things in the first sentence? Should it not be all ravens are black things, and therefore all non-black things are non-ravens?
I can put it in if you like. I don't think it's really necessary. Because, I mean, you just mean they're coloured black, don't you? And here, you're saying all things that aren't black.
You have to identify what a non-black in the second sentence.
Well, that's because here I'm talking about all ravens, whereas here I'm talking about all non-ravens.
Okay.
Aren't I?
Yeah.
And so I need the things in there. Anyway, I think that's a bit of a red herring.
Oh, okay.
Now, given that a white gym shoe is a non-black non-raven, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, if all ravens are black is confirmed by the sighting of a black raven, it also ought also to be confirmed by the sighting of a white gym shoe, which is a non-black non-raven. Do you see the problem? You hate it. Why do you hate it?
I think it almost seems like at school it's like this thing, you know, where all Chinamen wear brown shoes, and they're if you wear brown shoes, you're a Chinaman, you know.
Well, it would have to be all and only Chinamen wear brown shoes. Therefore, if you wear brown shoes, you're a Chinaman.
But so I can see how it's absolutely fine with non-black things, so it's a non-raven. But the sighting of a white gym shoe
does not
confirm that ravens are black.
Okay, why not?
Not very persuasive, is it?
But why not? Okay, here, you're absolutely right. None of us think for one minute that the sighting of a white gym shoe is any confirmation of the theory that all ravens are black. But the logic says it is. Mm-hmm. As far as logic is concerned, the sighting of a white gym shoe should be every bit as much a confirmation of all ravens are black as the sighting of a black raven. So what is it that, that means that it's not persuasive? Because you're quite right, it's not persuasive.
I would say it's because of probability.
Go on.
Then if I... The number of things that are not raven, is, I would say in my mind, is far more than ravens.
Good, well done. What you're doing is you're bringing your to bear your background knowledge of the world to tell you that actually this is a world in which there are many, many more non-black non-ravens than there are non-ravens. Imagine a world in which there are just 11 things. Okay, you know that this is a world where there are only 11 things. And you know that 10 of them, apart from yourself, can I just leave myself out of this? Okay, I know there are only 10 things. And 9 of them are ravens, and 9 of them are black. Okay, in that world, the sighting of a white gym shoe would be conclusive confirmation of the claim that all ravens are black, wouldn't it? Do you see? And what that paradox, the ravens paradox it calls, and it was a chap called Hempel, Carl Hempel, who came up with it. What that shows you is that the necessity of background information. We unthinkingly bring to bear our background beliefs about the world in deciding what does test our hypotheses and what doesn't. So you have a hypothesis, all ravens are black. You think, I know what confirms that, it's the sighting of a black raven. And what you don't realise is you're smuggling in background beliefs about the world. Actually, I'm going to do Gru. I may regret this, but let's have a go.
Marion, sorry, just before you leave
yes.
that one. All of that would make sense to me, but the first sentence said, all black things are ravens. The fact that it says...
No, it doesn't.
No, it doesn't.
Oh.
Therefore, to me, it doesn't make sense. Because if by saying all black things are ravens... all ravens are black. Ergo, there is no such thing as a not black raven. All non-black things, any other colour, is not a raven. I still think that allows room in the world for things that are black and are not ravens. It doesn't exclude it, that those two sentences.
For things that are black and not ravens.
Black but aren't ravens.
But those are irrelevant to this, aren't they?
Well, then it isn't when you bring in the gym shoe.
Well, no, because a gym shoe is a non-black, non-raven. It's
but
not it's, a black
no,
non-raven.
No, it says all ravens are black. It doesn't say every black item in the world is a raven.
Can we make it a different... Sorry, I need someone with arms. Come on. Okay, keep that up there. Okay, what you're saying is that it doesn't say that there are... So this is consistent with there are black non-ravens.
Yes.
I.e. Marianne's boots.
Yes.
Okay, is that what you're saying?
Yes.
Okay, but that's true, but why is that relevant to this? Because this is saying all ravens are black.
Yeah.
Can I leave out the things? I mean, it bothers me. Okay, all ravens are black. So all non-black things are non-ravens. Doesn't say all black things must be ravens.
No.
At any point, does it?
No.
You're getting your Venn diagrams mixed up.
Oh, I thought that.
Okay, do you see how you're getting your... So
you see a white gym shoe, you know it's not a raven...
And you know it's not black.
You definitely know it's not black. Why does that...
My black boots are completely irrelevant to the confirmation either of all ravens are black, because my boots aren't ravens, and it's also irrelevant to the confirmation of all non-black things are non-ravens, because they're not non-black.
Right. I'll digest that for a while.
Okay. Does everyone else agree with me? Does anyone want to argue with that? What you're doing is you're making a mistake. No, I'm not going to
Don't worry,
that.
I'll yeah, it'll be in
Yes, you'll dismiss. Thank you very much. I'm just going to quickly do Gru.
Sorry, Ariel, I have a question. Now,
Yeah,
just before, when you said there's only 10 things, and 9 of them are all black, and 1 of them wasn't, right?
There are only 10 things, 9 of them are black, and 9 of them are ravens.
Okay, and that seemed to me, when you talked about the Venn diagram there, effectively you have a set that you know are 9, and you have one thing that's in a set, so you know that that set is not a subset of that, they stand alone. But that's only because you know the population of the set.
Well, if we have 9 things, there are 10 things, okay? 9 things are ravens,
yep.
So there's 1 non-raven.
Yep.
And 9 things are black, so there's 1 non-black thing. Okay, but these needn't be the same thing, need they?
No.
So one of the you could have a white raven in this world.
Yep.
But if you see a white gym shoe,
you know that exclusion. There must be 9 black ravens.
That you know exactly. Yep. You must. You know that all ravens are black. Do you see?
Yep.
Okay. So the idea is that when you bring to bear your background knowledge of that world, you know that seeing the white gym shoe confirms all ravens are black. Whereas when you bring to bear what you believe about this world, you know that seeing the white gym shoe doesn't confirm all ravens are black. And the moral of the tale is we don't even notice that we're bringing to bear that background information when we decide what will confirm our theories. And here's another paradox of confirmation. No, you said Emerald, the Raven's Agreement. Okay, all observed emeralds, every emerald we've ever observed has been green. I don't know if that's true or not, but it's irrelevant whether it's true or not. Let's just say all observed emeralds have been green. And therefore, we're going to form the hypothesis all emeralds are green. Okay? But a chap called Goodman, Nelson Goodman, wanted us to say, well, okay, if we define Gru, as X is Gru, if X is green and observed or blue and unobserved, then we have as much reason to think that all emeralds are Gru as we do for thinking all emeralds are green. Okay, and you might think, well, hang on a second, Gru is a made-up predicate. Well, yeah, but okay, lobsters we know are blink, aren't they? They're either brown and uncooked or pink and cooked, aren't they? So lobsters are blink. So and there's nothing wrong with blink. So why should we think there's anything wrong with Gru? And do you see that actually, if you define Gru thus, we do have every bit as much evidence for the truth of all emeralds are Gru as we do for all emeralds are green. Because every emerald we have ever seen has been Gru.
Yes.
Hasn't it? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. And what's more, every emerald we see from now on is going to confirm all emeralds are Gru, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah.
And that's because the minute we see it, it will be green and therefore grew. Do you see what I mean? Well, exactly the same with the ravens thing. We absolutely know, we take ourselves to know that emeralds are not grew. We just won't project the predicate grew, and yet we will project the predicate green. Well, why? Why do we think that green is an acceptable predicate but grew isn't? There's no doubt that we do think that, but why do we think that? Because actually, again, the logic tells us there's no difference between all emeralds are green and all emeralds are grew.
Yeah, that makes it a lot clearer, because every time I come across this argument...
You were the one who asked me, were you?
I was indeed. There seemed, locked into the argument, there seemed to be a date involved.
You don't
before
need
a particular date and after a particular date, and that really confused me because it seemed too arbitrary in many ways.
Yeah, no, sometimes people put a date in here and say X is grew if X is green
before
T or blue after T.
Yeah.
And actually that just confuses everything. This is much better.
Yes, certainly did.
Can anyone tell me why we don't project grew? You can tell, I hope, that the answer is going to be comparable to the answer to the Raven's puzzle.
Well, I would give a different answer. I would say that grew or green are just labels, and we know there's a content of green, and we know there's a content of grew.
Ah, no, I dealt with that with a blink. No, you don't know there's no content to grew. You don't know that.
Well,
I mean, we have as much evidence for emeralds of grew as we do for emeralds of green.
Mm. It's based on the preponderance of the evidence the word grew doesn't exist.
I'm sorry, the word blink is a perfectly good predicate, isn't it? There's nothing wrong with the predicate grew. That's not the answer. Let me tell you the answer, because I'm going to go on too long. Sorry?
Is it to do with the belief in the uniformity of nature?
All of this is to do with the belief in the uniformity of nature.
Okay.
But what I'm asking, I suppose, is which bit of nature is deemed to be uniform in this case. The answer is that we have no reason, do we, to think that things change colour when we observe them, or things like emeralds change colour when we observe them. We do have reason to think that lobsters change colour when we cook them. So we're quite prepared to accept that lobsters are blink. But we don't have any background beliefs about emeralds changing colour when we look at them. So although we have every bit as much evidence for grew as we do emeralds of grew as emeralds of green, our background knowledge has come to bear and says, no, actually it's, well, all emeralds are green that we project and we form as a hypothesis, not all emeralds are grew.
Mm.
Right. I think you preferred the ravens one, didn't you? Mm. Maybe I shouldn't have tried grew. Okay, so this is Popper, who is completely different, when I say nothing to do with this, I mean, of course he did, he was a philosopher of science and a very good one. But he was saying something different. What he was saying is, we should never try and confirm hypotheses. All these paradoxes are our reason to think that actually confirmation is just not the way we're going. You know, one tick every time you see a black raven or a white gym shoe. Instead, scientists should try and falsify hypotheses, and they say of theories that they haven't yet been falsified. But actually, in saying this, Popper illustrates Hume's claim that we can't manage without induction. Why should we believe, after all, that a hypothesis that has been falsified at T will again be falsified at T plus one? We can't reject a theory just because it's been falsified, because that assumes that we think it'll be falsified next time we test it. And why would we think that if we weren't using induction, which is what we've been told we shouldn't use? So we're relying on the PUN even when we try and falsify things. So Popper was wrong to think we could give up induction. And anyone, and that may include people here, who think that induction is somehow inferior to deduction because it doesn't give us certainty, you're manifesting your failure to understand that without induction we couldn't learn anything new about the world at all. Induction isn't inferior, I can't say that often enough, it's just different. Okay, so there's deduction and induction. Deduction gives us certainty. Induction never gives us certainty, but that doesn't mean that induction isn't a way of acquiring knowledge. In fact, it's our only way of acquiring knowledge about our actual world, about the world in which we live.
You just said exactly that point, because you made the point that induction can never be certain, whereas deduction is always certain, or
well,
validly.
It's either certain or of no use at all.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that was Popper's argument.
Well,
how does the level of certainty come into this? Because there may be situations where you can actually say, in there's probability of that outcome being generated. We've identified 50% probability, but we haven't identified another 50%.
I'm sorry, I don't understand the question. But let
there's
me repeat.
There's a level of certainty.
Well, deduction will give us absolute logical certainty. We know beyond all possible logical doubt that if a deductive argument is valid and the premises are true, the conclusion will be true. There is absolutely no doubt about that. It will never change. It's completely conclusive. We've got absolute certainty about it. Whereas the truth of an inductive conclusion can never be established certainly on the basis of an inductive argument. Never.
Can it
doesn't matter how good the argument is.
Can it ever be a level of certainty?
Well, there can be a different level of probability.
Yeah.
I mean, the thing about, if you remember going back to the, I can't remember which week, but when we were looking at the difference between induction and deduction, deduction is an either all matter. It's either valid or it's invalid, end of story. Whereas induction is always a matter of degree. It's either weak or strong, and therefore everything in between can be any of those things. And of course, background information can be brought to bear to change that probability level. Okay. Okay, so the three qualities of induction mentioned above or before, I don't think that's really a word, ampliativity, but never mind, non-monotonicity, and that's certainly not a word, a prioricity.
Yeah.
So far, they've made it impossible for us to systematise the evaluation of inductive arguments in the way we've systematised the evaluation of deduction. What I gave you last week was one method for testing any deductive arguments. You can use that same method and it will always show you whether a deductive argument is valid or invalid. We can't do that with induction. Deductive validity is extremely well understood. It's annoying that it throws up things like the paradoxes of entailment, but actually they don't bother us and they don't stop us creating computers that get better and better and better all the time. But inductive strength isn't very well understood at all, notwithstanding the mathematical theory of statistical probability. There are very good accounts of probability that are systematized in the way that deduction is systematized, but I'm not going to talk about that because we're not doing mathematics here and I don't know enough about it. Okay, what is clear though is that there are strong inductive arguments and weak inductive arguments and everything in between. And we know a lot about how to evaluate the different types of induction. And that's what we're going to do. So before we look at the different types of induction, we should remind ourselves that we always want the premises of our arguments to be true. So just as with respect to deductive arguments, we always ask these two questions. Okay, are the premises true? Is the argument valid? With inductive arguments, we always ask, are the premises true and is the argument strong? Okay, so those are the two key things. When you come to evaluating arguments, those are the two key questions that you ask yourself. Now, notice I said I classify inductive arguments. Thus, if you go onto the web, you'll see that there are lots of different classifications, and I just gave up trying. I thought I'm just going to decide how to do it myself. That's how I do it. Some people think that abductive arguments are neither inductive or deductive. I don't agree with that. I think they're inductive. But again, if you go on the web, you'll see, and I've given you some references at the end of this week, which will help you on that. That's how I classify them. And what we're going to do is we'll look at each type of argument, making sure we know how to recognise it, and then we'll go back to each one and learn how to evaluate it. Okay, first of all, inductive generalisations. That's the first type of inductive argument. This type of argument makes claims from about whole populations from observations of samples of those populations. So every swan I've ever seen has been white, therefore all swans are white. Or every raven I've ever seen has been black, therefore all
Jimmy's are white.
All non-black things are non-white. Okay, do you see how that's an inductive generalisation? It takes some observations and extrapolates the observations to the rest of the population, for the rest of the things that have been observed. Okay. I realised last time I did these lectures that lots of people get confused about this. Deductive arguments have premises that must be based on induction. So this argument is a deductive argument. All swans are white, the bird in the next room is a swan, therefore the bird in the next room is white. Do you see that that's deductive? Deductively valid. But that premise must be an inductive premise, mustn't it? The only way we could have got to that is on the basis of an inductive argument. And what this shows you is that actually science is based on both induction and deduction, because you need your induction to get your hypotheses, but then you need your deduction to get your the test that you're going to carry out on your premises. So don't ever think that induction is what scientists do. They don't go for deduction. Of course they do. They have to for this reason. And that's a deductive argument, even though the first premise is a classical claim from induction. Okay, this is the second type of inductive argument, causal generalisations. These make claims about causation on the basis of claims about correlations. Now, this is just a type of inductive generalisation, because it's taking observations and extrapolating them into the future. So what we do is we've seen A and B always correlated, therefore they will always be correlated in the future. And we call always correlated in that way causation, or we often do. Our evidence for causation is constant conjunction or a correlation. So here we might say many of the people at Jane's party on Saturday were ill on Sunday. Their illness must have been caused by something they ate at Jane's place. Okay, that's a causal generalisation. I probably shouldn't have put the word must in there because it's going to confuse you and make you think it's deductive, but it isn't. So we've got a correlation here, and we're saying that that's evidence for cause. Okay, that's a causal generalisation. Analogies are also inductive arguments. They make claims about things on the basis of claims about their similarity to other things. So the universe is like a watch. Watches have makers. We've never seen a watch without a maker. Therefore, the universe must have a maker. Okay? Do you see? So it's extrapolating the similarity, or rather on the basis of the similarity. Arguments from authority make claims about the correctness of things someone says on the basis of that person's being an authority. So if you like, they've said things that have been correct in the past, therefore in the future they're going to say things that are correct. Do you see how that rests on the principle of uniformity of nature? So Einstein says that nothing goes faster than the speed of light in a vacuum, therefore nothing goes faster than the speed of light in a vacuum. Einstein says P, therefore P. An abductive argument, finally, make claims about their arguments to the best explanation. You've probably heard them called before. Abductive arguments, they make claims about which explanations are likely to be correct on the basis of observations about the sort of explanations that have been correct in the past. So you might say crop circles are eventually going to be explained by science, because in the past many things thought to be susceptible only to supernatural explanations have been explained by science. Okay, so here you're saying that scientific explanations are good explanations, and they will eventually explain crop circles.
Can we go back to the watchmaker, please?
No, because I'm just about to get on to evaluating these arguments. So I haven't looked at how to evaluate them yet. All we've done is how to recognise them.
I wanted to argue that was a deductive argument.
That's a deductive argument. Why?
Premise one, the universe is like a watch. Premise two, watches have makers. Their conclusion, therefore, the universe has a maker.
So is there any possible situation in which that's true, and that's false? Can anyone think of a situation in which that's true, and that's false?
Yeah.
Okay. Does that mean that that's not a good argument? Does that make that argument invalid? No.
No.
It's not a deductive argument, it's an inductive argument. Do you see why?
Yeah. Because it's like a watch, not
is. Yeah, exactly. If it said the universe is a watch, watches have makers, therefore the universe has a maker, that would be a deductive argument. Yes.
It's because it's an analogy.
Yeah. Well, yes. Right. Okay, have we done that?
Yes.
Yeah. And we've done that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, so can we classify these arguments by type? Many undergraduates like to get drunk at the weekend, so I should imagine that as it's Saturday, James may be in the pub.
Generalisation.
It's a generalisation, an inductive generalisation. Yep, good. Okay. What about Jessamy as the chief executive officer? So if she said expenses won't be paid today, then expenses won't be paid today.
Authority.
Yeah. Often after I've been in an aeroplane, I've developed a cold. I'm travelling to Johannesburg on Saturday, so I'm expecting to have a cold by Tuesday.
Causation.
Yes, I wasn't sure about that one myself. It's either inductive or it's causal, isn't it? Either way, it's one of the two. Okay, bankers are like vampire bats. They suck our blood and should be destroyed. I apologise to our bankers.
Just true.
Just true won't do. What sort of argument is that?
Analogy.
It's another analogy, that's right. The last three times I've asked Susan what was on at the cinema, she misled me, so I shan't ask her again. There's an argument implied there, isn't there, rather than an argument.
Causal generalisation.
It's an inductive generalisation. Yes, I'm not sure causal is.
I'm just like correlating. From correlation.
Yes, not all correlations are taken as evidence for cause. I mean, husbands and wives are correlated, they don't cause each other. Many children have developed autism shortly after having been given the MMR jab, therefore the MMR jab causes autism. That's a causal generalisation, yeah. And unfortunately, that was the one that was underneath Andrew Wakeman's claim, which led to the loss of herd immunity, because many children have developed autism shortly after having been given the MMR jab, but that's because the MMR jab is given at roughly the time children develop autism, or just before the time that children develop autism. There is a correlation there, but no causation. Okay, so next we're going to learn how to evaluate those arguments. We're going to learn this by listing the questions to which we'd like answers and seeing why we'd like answers to them. And after each one, I'm going to include an exercise, but this is this week's homework exercises. So you'll get the answers to those next week. We won't do them now, which is just as well. Okay, and we'll always be asking, assuming the premises of the argument are true, how strong a reason are they to believe that the conclusion of the argument is true? So if you remember, the two questions I gave you at the beginning, are the premises true? Is the argument strong? This is the second part of that second question that you should be asking. So, evaluating inductive generalisations. Every swan we have ever seen has been white, therefore every swan is white. Well, firstly, you need to recognise what's the sample and what's the population. So here you've got, what is the sample here? It's swans we have seen, isn't it? Okay, so all you could say is that every swan I've ever seen has been white. I assume that every swan I've ever seen is representative of all swans, therefore all swans are white. Okay, so that's the sample and that's the population. You need to know something about how large the sample is. I mean, how many swans have we actually seen? Who is this we? Is it me and my pal? Or is it all English people, for example, or all scientists, or all naturalists, or who is it? Have we any idea how the number of swans we've seen compares with the number of swans there are, the number in the population taken as a whole? The next question we ask is the sample representative of the population? Do we think there's something odd or special about the swans that we've seen? I mean, there was a very popular example is used of an American election in which they did a poll, who's going to vote for whoever it was. And when it came back, it said something 60% are going to vote for this person. In the result, it was something like 10%. And what had turned out is they had conducted the poll by telephone. But actually, very few people owned telephones in those days. And the people who owned telephones tended to be the rich people who were going to say, yes, they would vote for this person. Whereas those who didn't have phones, the vast majority, were less likely to vote for that person. So you need to know whether your sample is representative of the population, because if it isn't, then what you're going to get out is, well, you've heard the saying, rubbish in, rubbish out. And also, you want to know if there are any counterexamples. I mean, this we here, you know, who is it? I mean, we have seen only ever white swans, but has anyone else seen any other type of swan? So the claim all swans are white was seen to be false in 1790 when John Latham sailed up the Swan River, it's called, for that very reason, in Western Australia, and discovered black swans. Okay, do you think that his discovery meant that the argument for the claim that all swans are white was a bad argument?
No.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because we now know that the conclusion of that argument is categorically false. Mm-hmm. It's not the case that all swans are white. But actually, it wasn't obviously a bad argument, was it, in the first place? Because at the time, we'd seen many swans. We'd seen them in lots of different places. Lots of people had seen different ones. All these answers could have led us to think that actually this was quite a good argument.
So it was an example of Popper's principle being used.
Well, it's
up until that point.
Yes, and in fact, a book's just been written called Black Swan Events or something. Black Swan Events are the falsification of something that everyone takes to be absolutely normal. But do you see how induction works? All the evidence you have in suggests that this hypothesis, all swans are white, is true. And then one falsification of it comes up and shows that actually it doesn't matter. So a bit more information and the whole argument's just blown. So actually it doesn't necessarily mean that it was a bad argument. Okay, any questions about inductive generalisations and how to evaluate them?
And it's not statistical, you only need the one.
It's certainly the case with a counterexample. Just as you have counterexamples to deductive arguments, once you've got the word all in there, you can come up with a counterexample. Yeah. If we'd concluded many swans are white,
that would be that.
The sighting of a black swan wouldn't have falsified it.
David Deutsch reckons that the sort of arguments you're talking about, particularly
the sort of water.
Arguments or debates you're talking about, particularly extrapolating, is very post-Enlightenment. It's based on empiricism, isn't it? we have seen that to be true, therefore it is true. And he argues that that is only, that's the paradigm we work to because we're all post-Enlightenment, and that it wasn't true before and it shouldn't be in the future. Discuss.
I don't want to comment on David Deutsch because I haven't heard him make this argument. But I do want to say it's certainly the case that in the Enlightenment we started to take note of observation and things. For example, I mean, up until the Enlightenment, people were saying Aristotle said P, therefore P. You know, end of story. So an argument from analogy was deemed perfectly acceptable as an argument. And there's a wonderful example of, can't remember his name now, but it was argued that the number of planets was seven because there are seven ways of knowing about the world. And I can't remember exactly how it went, but I might have used it later on. But during the Enlightenment, we became very interested in empirical evidence for things, i.e. correlations. We looked for, the principle of the uniformity of nature became very important. Yeah. But don't think for one minute that the inductive argument can take over from deduction. Deduction is every bit as important as induction, and they're quite different. This is quite a good question because I can get quite annoyed when I see people in the newspapers talking about we need evidence for this. And actually, I think it should be we need evidence or arguments, because there are some, certain things for which you'll never have evidence because you argue for them. Deduction is the only way to show that they're true. So we have evidence and arguments. It's not just evidence. So deduction's never going to go away. I mean, that's just nonsense.
Well, what do we do about if the sample size is known, but what if we don't understand or know
how big the population is? Then we won't be able to, we should in that case probably hedge our bets on the conclusions we make. So if we had said many swans are white, maybe most swans are white, we wouldn't have had our conclusions falsified by the sighting of a black swan, would we? So we tell students that they shouldn't conclude, you know, make an argument stronger from than the arguments that they've got. Sorry, a conclusion stronger than the arguments got can bear, and that's true here as well. Do you remember I talked about inductive boldness at some point?
Yeah.
Different people are differently inductively bold. So. You might come in and see me wearing earrings once and think, oh, Marianne always wears earrings, you know, whereas you'll want to see me 100 times before you think, oh, yes, she always wears earrings. So you're more inductively bold than you are. You need more evidence for your claims.
Just wanted to ask, so in these current arguments, we are moving from logical possibility to physical possibility, or the whole business of swans.
Well, you could see it like that. Whether there's any such thing as physical necessity is actually a big question. We know there's logical necessity. David Hume had things to say about physical necessity. So our only evidence for causation is correlation. We see two things that are always correlated, one's always prior to the other, etc. Actually, I'm going to talk about this a bit when I get on to causal generalisation, so would you mind if I just carried on?
Yep.
And if I don't answer your question, come back to me again. Two more questions, then I'd better move on.
With regard to the swans one, in practice, what difference does it make? Because all
what
swans,
difference does what make?
Well, I'm just about to ask. All swans are white was seen for hundreds of years to be upheld by the experience of mankind.
Yeah.
And then, in a particular circumstance, a very particular circumstance, there was an exception. At that point, it changed from all swans are white to, I don't know, most swans are white, but there was another statement. that replaced it.
Yeah, or all swans in the western southern hemisphere.
That is likely to happen with all inductive arguments. When you make a claim, and that claim will carry on being held as the experience or the truth for the population until it bumps up against another reality.
Yeah.
And at that point it changes.
Degrees of probability, I think, isn't it?
Yes. Mm-hmm. So it's cautioning against saying this was false.
It's only false because it's all swans are white. I mean, if you say that,
all swans are white was true.
It was no more the case all swans were white was true than that the earth was flat was true when everyone believed the earth was flat. We believed it was true.
I'm not following you down that path.
I can give you an example.
All swans are white. If I have a cage that's got swans in it, and all the swans in it are white, and I say all swans are white, it's true then, isn't it?
It might be all the swans in my cage are white, might be true, but not all swans are white.
But if the experience of human nature up until 1790...
He's playing right into my hands, I'm enjoying this. Go on.
All right. If up until 1790, the experience of human life, or animal life, was that all swans are white, it was true. It was, there were no reason to believe otherwise.
What's your name?
I'm not going to give
Stop
you...
Stop laughing! What's his name?
See me off before.
Go on, what's your name?
William.
William. Okay, you've given me the opportunity to do something I love doing, so I think this is wonderful. Okay, William... ...believes... Marianne is wearing red. Is that true?
Today.
Yeah.
No.
God, you are nitpickers, aren't you?
The whole thesis about nitpicking.
Jack, no, you're nitpickers, but I'm not nitpicking. Okay, good. Is that true?
Yes.
Good. Okay. Right, now I want you to notice that there are two sentences here. There's one big sentence and it embeds another sentence here. Sorry, it's a shame it's such a long sentence, but there's the one sentence, William believes Marianne's wearing red, and there's embedded in that, there's another sentence, Marianne's wearing red. Is that fair enough?
Yes.
Okay. Now, could that one be true and that one be false?
Yes.
Yeah. Yep. Okay. Could that one be false and that one be true?
Yes.
Yep. So Marianne's wearing red, but William doesn't believe it. He didn't come today, and so he's not seen me, so he doesn't have any beliefs about what I'm wearing. Okay. Could they both be true?
Yes.
And could they both be false?
Yes.
Yes.
Yep. Okay. What that tells us is that the truth value of that belief differs quite independently from the truth value of the embedding belief. The only way you'll miss that is if you take the expression Marianne's wearing red is true for William. Okay, now that's ambiguous. One might be just that William believes Marianne is wearing red. Okay, Marianne's wearing red is true for William, just means William believes, therefore William believes it's true that Marianne's wearing red. And the other one, Marianne's wearing red is true for William, even if not for anyone else.
You might be colorblind.
Okay, now that is just straightforwardly acceptable, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, we understand that. We know exactly that people sometimes form beliefs, for all sorts of reasons. That one is a very strange thing to say, isn't it? If we say Marianne's wearing red is true for William, even if not for anyone else, in other words, not that it's just that he believes it, but that it's true for him, well, surely either I'm wearing red or I'm not. Mm-hmm. And if I am wearing red, then it's true for everyone else, not just William. Mm-hmm. And if I'm not wearing red, it's not true for William either.
Even if he believes
that I am.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Do you see where I'm getting to, William? What I'm saying is that when everyone believed that the Earth was flat, that didn't make it true the Earth is flat. What it meant is that everyone believed the Earth was flat. Do you see, they believed it was true that the Earth was flat, didn't make it true that the Earth was flat.
Yeah.
This is an absolutely crucial logical point that actually many, many people miss and makes a huge problem for thinking about epistemology, metaphysics, anything to do about truth, in fact. Have I convinced you?
I accept that entirely, but the point I was making was, in practice, what difference does it make? Because you carry on believing it's flat until it's shown that it's round, and then you move on to a new truth basis.
Okay, you move on to a new belief.
A new belief.
At that point. Yeah, exactly. So, what difference does it make? Well, actually, because everything we do is a result of what we believe. And because if our beliefs are true, our actions are usually successful. In other words, the truth of our beliefs, we like to think, leads to the success of our actions. The falsehood of our beliefs leads to unsuccessful actions. We care whether our beliefs are true. So it does make a difference. All that's happened here is that we overgeneralized, but actually we probably say that we have perfectly good reason to overgeneralize. And in fact, human beings are given to overgeneralizing. I mean, we're generally much more inductively bold than we should be. And one of the things about being a scientist is that you should rein in your inductive boldness. You shouldn't say that you've shown something when in fact you haven't.
Thank you.
But surely...
You can see why I enjoyed...
But, I mean, in defence of William, surely all inductive arguments are open to what you've just said, to describe
them. Yeah. Or inductive arguments never give us certainty. That's right. But they we got to the moon on them.
Yes.
I mean, there are quite a few inductive arguments involved in the calculations that took us to the moon. So, and science is based largely on induction. So, you know, just because it doesn't give us certainty doesn't mean it doesn't give us knowledge.
Yeah.
It probably gives us more than a starting point as well. It takes us to somewhere we otherwise couldn't have gone.
Mm.
Yeah. Okay, can I move on? Goodness, we've only done inductive generalisations. Okay, there are some to do at home. Okay, evaluating causal generalisations now. Many of the people at Jane's party on Saturday night were ill on Sunday. The illness must have been caused by something being at Jane's party. Okay, questions we should ask. Firstly, how many correlations have been observed? It says many here, many of the people at Jane's party, implying that not all of them, because there were some people at Jane's party who didn't get ill. So how many correlations were there between people who were at Jane's party and people who got ill? Under what circumstances have correlations been observed? I mean, was it Freya, who wasn't invited to the party and doesn't like Jane, who tells us that a lot of the people who were at Jane's party got ill? If so, you know, we might question that. I mean, I suppose I'm going against we're assuming that the premises are correct, aren't we? So maybe that's unfair, but you can see why we'd ask that. Are there any exceptions to the correlation? Are there any who were ill who weren't at Jane's party? We know that there were some at Jane's party who weren't ill, but are there any who were ill who weren't at Jane's party? We might ask. And that's continued, okay. Could the correlations be accidental? Could the illnesses have had variable causes? So it's just an accident that all the ill people were at Jane's party, or most of the ill people were at Jane's party. Could the correlations be explained by a common cause? Did Jane throw her party because of an earlier event at which those who were ill might have caught something or eaten something bad? So maybe Jane had the party because we all went to the Olympics that day and saw, and we ate a hamburger and it made us all ill. Jane's party was actually nothing to do with it. Could the causal relation run the other way? And could it be that it was because they were going to get ill that certain people went to Jane's party? I mean, you know, I'm sure there must be people here who run chickenpox parties. Is that right? So the people who went to that party went to the party because they wanted to get ill, didn't they? And does the causal relation make sense? Pineapples and striking matches, this is how it was taught me and I continue to use it numerous years later. If it had been in the history of the universe true that every time a pineapple dropped from a tree, a match was struck, would we think that there was a causal relation between the dropping of the pineapple and the striking of the match?
Yeah.
You would. Okay, some people think that just the correlation is sufficient to give us a causal relation. Other people would want to say we want to see whether it makes sense first, because we can't think of a mechanism, can we, whereby the dropping of a pineapple from a tree would lead to the striking of a match. But of course, that may be just our lack of imagination.
It goes back to the last
ones. But an example of that is that effectively people had very few people had a sneaky view that sunspots caused stock markets to go up on futures for whatever.
Yeah.
And effectively it worked out that sunspots then therefore caused subsequent good harvests. And therefore, grains came up and there was prosperity.
Oh, right.
And
there
so, the linking point, people just didn't understand what those linking points were.
Yeah. Well, and the same could be true of pineapples and striking.
Pineapples and
But we need to have a story told, don't we, before we start to find it convincing. Okay, and thinking about causal, I mean, nearly everyone knows someone who smoked for decades. I mean, my father, then he died of emphysema. So my father is not a good example, but most people know someone who smoked for decades and yet has no sign of lung cancer in their 80s. Does this mean that smoking doesn't cause cancer, do you think?
No.
Does it?
No.
It does mean that smoking doesn't, but that, I mean, in exactly the same way, you say you've got sighting of one swan, doesn't really show that the argument all swans are white wasn't a good one. I mean, it shows that that conclusion is wrong. In the same way, actually, here we know that we've got the natural uniformity wrong somewhere, haven't we? So if you make a distinction between the natural necessities that we think of as ruling our world, the laws of nature that exist and are as they are quite independently of us, and that we try and discover, we try and observe. So there are laws which are linguistic entities. We're trying to get our laws to correctly describe these natural necessities, aren't we? And we think, whereas lack of correlation is evidence for error, isn't it? If we think A causes B, and then we see an A and not a B, that's evidence for error there, isn't it?
Yes.
I mean, what we know now is that it's not that A causes B, it's that A stars cause B, or that A's in certain contexts cause B's, or that there's something in addition to A that causes B. So I think that what we know from the fact that we do know people who haven't developed lung cancer, is that there is something more to the claim that smoking causes cancer than that just smoking causes, because if it was just smoking, there wouldn't be any smokers who didn't have cancer.
Nor does it say inevitably, does it? Doesn't say, does this mean that that smoking inevitably causes cancer, which it would, which would clearly be wrong, judging by the first sentence. But it doesn't mean it doesn't cause it.
Yeah, but we do tend to well, we think of causation, if A causes B, we think of A as being sufficient for B.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And therefore, if you get an A without a B, you know that A isn't sufficient to B, and you need to add something else to it. So we know we haven't yet quite got there. There's something more to it. Maybe there's a genetic element or an environmental element or something like that. But we do know that it can't be smoking just on its own. But we do know that actually the probability of getting lung cancer from smoking is very high. We just, as you say, it's not deterministic.
This
one, A, two, and then we'll move on.
A causes B. Does it mean that A always, is the phrase, does, is this a bit interpreted that A always causes B?
Well, if we say A causes B, and then we see an A and not a B, that's usually thought of as falsifying that, isn't it?
Is it?
Yeah.
I think that most people, I don't know if this is a language thing, but I would have thought that most, I mean, when a scientist is trying to show that A causes B, what you're trying to show is that A is sufficient for B.
You could take a clear example, you could say birch pollen causes asthma. We certainly don't believe that everyone, it depends, you have to have an allergy.
Well, then you know that birch pollen doesn't cause asthma, there's something
in
addition.
The person, yes, but
yeah,
then the people,
there's something in addition as well. Well, you could take the word causation to mean a probabilistic type of causation, and I agree that in many cases we do mean it thus, I think. So when we say that smoking causes cancer, we don't mean it's deterministic, but we do mean there's a high element of risk of getting lung cancer if you smoke. Very high element of risk. Okay, who is?
It could be that smoking always causes lung cancer, but sometimes you don't live long enough for it to happen.
Mm-hmm.
So the limiting parameter could be age. You might die of something else before it.
Yeah,
happens.
So I mean, if this chap went on to lose 105, he might get it too.
Yeah,
could be.
Are there any examples of lung cancer without smoking?
Yes.
Oh,
yes.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a high incidence. I wouldn't know.
I wouldn't know either.
I do.
Does anyone know? Go on. Is there a high incidence of lung cancer without smoking?
Yes. There are causal things. If you work with asbestos and you smoke, you will get lung cancer or mesothelioma. It's, as you said, it isn't exclusive.
It
isn't deterministic. It's putting it together.
Yeah. And also, passive smoking. Yeah.
But
I was going to say, I mean, having grown up in a house where somebody smoked 60 a day for 16 years sort of thing, mind you, I smoked myself, I have to admit, at one point as well. But let's say I hadn't, then I might still get cancer that was still smoking linked, even though I had never myself smoked. Anyway, this is a red herring. Let's carry on. Okay, you can do these at home. Sleeping with your shoes on gives you headaches. Is that a good causal argument?
Definitely.
If you've seen a correlation between sleeping with your shoes on and headaches?
Yes. Drunk.
So there might be a common cause that leads to both sleeping with one shoes on and having a headache. Okay, do that at home. Evaluating analogies. Okay, you greatly enjoyed Barchester Towers, so I'm sure you will enjoy Can You Forgive Her? They're similar in all sorts of ways. Well, okay, is the claimed similarity relevant to the conclusion drawn? I mean, if you say, well, in what way are they similar? And I say, well, they were both published by Penguin. Or they're both in green covers. You might think, what's that got to do with it? We might want to know how many respects they're similar. So if you tell me that it would be a good thing to buy a... Oh, sorry, I tell you that it would be a good thing to buy a Toyota Yaris because, you know, mine's been fine. Then the fact that it was also owned by a very safe middle-aged woman for so many years, and she looked after it very carefully, and you know, all these things. The more I can add similarities between the one you're thinking of buying and the one I've got that I'm prepared to recommend, the better the analogy. We might want respects in which the two things are dissimilar. So, okay, the subject matter in Barchester Towers differs from Can You Forgive Her? Is that, I mean, if you really only go for ecclesiastical novels, then the fact that this isn't one, or at least not as obviously, might make you think, well, actually, that's a disanalogy that would matter. As with the watchmaker one, I mean, are there disanalogies between the universe and the watch that make us think that even if a watch does have a maker, maybe the universe doesn't? One question at the back there.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that there's far less, I don't see any relevance to the watchmaker and the universe thing, whereas there is a relevance here.
Well, with the watchmaker and the universe, the idea is that the watch is regular and runs according to a mechanism. Oh, and in the same way, the universe is regular, runs according to mechanisms.
I see.
So that's the idea. Okay, in 1992, the marketing people at Hoover reasoned that because the take-up of air tickets to Europe on a recent promotion had been low, a promotion offering air tickets to the US in exchange for buying £100 worth of Hoover products would also be low. Was it? Does anyone remember this? No, it wasn't. And actually, they lost a huge amount of money as a result of this bad analogy. What are the disanalogies between air tickets to Europe and air tickets to the US on the basis of buying £100 worth of products?
Because the tickets to the US are far more expensive.
Exactly. Actually, this was a hugely cheap, I'm guessing, to the US. If you only had to buy £100 worth of products, you were, in effect, getting to the US for £100. They lost...
Millions.
I'm not sure. There were certainly millions. I'm not sure it wasn't billions. So, there you are, some analogies to evaluate at home. And evaluating arguments from authority. Several times in these lectures, I've told you you should just believe me about something. Well, should you?
Of course.
Thank you. Is the authority qualified? Okay, do I really know what I'm talking about here? Is the authority qualified in the appropriate area? Actually, there are many more philosophers far more qualified than I am in logic and critical reasoning. So if you have another authority who disagrees with me, then you should probably believe that authority rather than me. Do other authorities agree? Are there other philosophers who disagree with Marianne? Well, I can tell you right now, there are many, many, many of them, but probably not on the things that I've told you you should take from me. Because on the whole, I would have explained that there was disagreement if that was the case.
Apart from earrings and jeans.
Yeah, that's nothing. Yeah. Okay, could the authority be biased? Okay, so am I being paid by somebody who wants you to carry on reasoning appallingly to mislead you? How much they offered me. Can references be provided by whoever appeals to the authority? So, for example, can I provide references for the find? A couple of times I hope I've demonstrated I can. And also, if somebody said, well, Marianne said that, therefore it must be true to you, you would be within your rights to say, well, which lecture was it she did that? Can you show me on the handouts and so on? We need references when people appeal to authorities.
Should I be telling this to the BBC?
Yeah. What? Here's Judy Dench Sting and Judy Christie urged David Cameron to decriminalise possession of drugs. Okay, this was written in all the papers, presumably because of Judy Dench and so on. Is this an appeal to authority, do you think?
No. Celebrities, right.
It's a sort of appeal to authority, doesn't it? Otherwise, why introduce Judy Dench?
It's appeal to influence, isn't it?
It's an appeal to influence, that's right. And does it work? I mean, should we listen to Judy Dench on drug policy?
No.
Even though we love her and we think that she's wonderful and we really enjoy her films?
It depends on your sample.
I think it depends all this inductive on knowledge, on
We have no reason to think that Judi Dench knows any more about drugs.
Some people just know Judi Dench.
Yeah.
And they are convinced by Judi Dench. It depends the level of the culture level of the people that.
Okay, we're running late. Okay, there's two arguments to do it. And finally, walking along the beach, Fred, Hilary and Sam, and those of you who know anything about Hilary Putnam will know that that's who I'm referring to here, came across an excellent likeness of Winston Churchill drawn in the sand. Hilary expressed amazement that crawling ants could have made such a picture. Sam said there's no way it could be ants, it must have been the wind. And Fred insisted it must have been drawn by a person. And we might say, well, obviously, we should assume Fred's explanation is the true explanation. It's the best of the three. And by best, we mean it's the one, it's the most conservative one. It's the one that's most consistent with our other theories, etc. But here we need to ask, well, do we have other hypotheses? We've got three here. Could we offer another for why this likeness was drawn in the sand? Might there be an even better hypothesis? I mean, if saying that a hypothesis is the best, but it's the best of a bad lot, is not much use, is it? And are there hypotheses we're unable to formulate? So, for example, some people believe that it's obvious that that science is going to be able to explain all sorts of things like God, morality, rationality, etc., etc. And I've sometimes said to them that this is like a monkey being halfway up the tree on the way to the moon, and it says, "Oh, so far, so good." You know, you think actually there's a principled problem here, and how do we know that we're not in this situation with respect to this type of explanation? And there's. That was just an example of a use of abduction in science, because science uses abduction a lot, as you can imagine. And there's an abduction to evaluate at home. And there are some references for all the things that I've talked about today. And right, next week, we're going to be doing fallacies. It's the last week, and I'll try and bring all of you who brought stuff for me to have a look at. I'll try and have a look at it before next week. And I'll also devote some of next week to answering your questions. So if you have questions, can you bring them along to next week? And I'll try and answer them then. Sorry we've overrun. Bye.
Thank you.